midnight, round midnight. Haven't got the heart to stand those memories. When my heart is still with you.
The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Tuesday, April 8th. I'm your host, Christian Knutson.
And I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. In tonight's news, a lingering question over a Madison City Council seat has been settled, with another one on the way.
Local nonprofits grapple with yet more federal funding cuts.
We recap last week's protest of a former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. last week over ongoing atrocities in Gaza.
And in the second half, the milkweed outlines declining profits in the dairy industry, Stuff Your Face talks about mocktails, and Wildlife Weekly shares an early spring update.
All these stories and more on tonight's news, but first we go live to BBC for reports from around the world.
This is Danielle Jaworzniewska with the BBC News. Hello. Rescue workers in the Dominican Republic say 66 people are now confirmed to have died when a roof collapsed at a concert. Leonardo Rocha reports.
The accident happened during a concert by the veteran Dominican singer Ruby Perez at the Jet Set Club in the capital, Santo Domingo. The singer's fate is unclear. Those who were inside the club said it all happened suddenly and it felt like an earthquake. Among those who died were one of the band's musicians, a provincial governor, and a former baseball star, Octavio Dotel. He played in the U.S. Major League Baseball for over a decade and won the World Series in 2011.
Tuesday's rally on the U.S. stock markets has stalled after the Trump administration made clear that a 104% tariff on goods imported from China would go ahead on Wednesday. After 3 days of losses, Wall Street stocks had opened buoyantly as traders embraced talk of potential trade deals with Japan and South Korea. But later, the White House press secretary said President Trump had decided to press ahead with the new tariffs in the face of warnings from China that it would retaliate. Here's John Sudworth.
Here we are, just hours away from this swinging tariff being applied between the world's two biggest trading economies. No wonder the markets are nervous. And we saw it very clearly today, a little bit of a rally this morning in the hope that some of these comments from administration officials about the possibility of being able to negotiate on this, that the tariffs may come down, all that fell away.
Donald Trump acknowledged that his tariffs strategy had been somewhat explosive, but he said his officials were talking with many countries wanting trade deals. In the meantime, he said America would benefit from the higher tariff revenues.
For those of you that want to know the tariffs, you've been hearing about tariffs, we're taking in almost $2 billion a day in tariffs. $2 billion a day. And we're doing very well. And we're doing very well in making, I call them tailored deals, not off the rack. These are tailored, highly tailored deals.
Mr. Trump was speaking at a White House reception for invited coal miners. He announced measures to boost coal production and ordered the Justice Department to fight states trying to hold back growth in the industry. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has strongly condemned Israel's ongoing blockade of Gaza, saying it violates the Geneva Conventions. After more than a month of no food, fuel or medicines being allowed to enter the Strip, Mr. Guterres said the floodgates of horror have reopened, leaving civilians in what he called an endless death loop. He rejected a new Israeli proposal to control aid deliveries in Gaza, saying the UN would play no part in such a scheme. You're listening to the World News from the BBC. Israel's Supreme Court has blocked the sacking of the domestic security chief and given the government and the Attorney General until the end of next week to reach agreement over the plan. The Shin Bet chief, Ronan Bar, was set to be removed after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said last month that he no longer trusted him, a decision backed by the entire cabinet. He'll now remain in office until the 20th of April. A British study has found that extreme poverty can have as big an impact on the brain development of babies as being born prematurely. Researchers found that families with a low income and limited access to education and jobs can cause developmental problems in babies, even if they are born at full term. Those born at 25 weeks to a less deprived family faced fewer problems. Thousands of anti-government protesters have blocked a bridge in central Budapest in opposition to a ban on LGBT pride parades passed by the Hungarian parliament last month. They argue the law curbs the right to freedom of assembly and is part of a wider government policy to undermine democratic norms ahead of next year's parliamentary elections. This woman explained why she decided to protest.
I think that we've got nowhere to retreat. Until now, we've been able to try to make deals and look for compromises, but that time has passed. If we don't stand up for the rights of minorities and for our own fundamental rights, then who will when they come for us? We've reached the point where we have to stand up and say no more.
The reigning European football champions Real Madrid have been beaten 3-0 by Arsenal in the first leg of their Champions League quarter-final. Declan Rice scored two spectacular free kicks to help the London club take control ahead of the second leg in Spain. In Germany, Inter Milan scored in the 88th minute to beat Bayern Munich 2-1. BBC World News.
This is Christian Knutsen and Sarah Hopeful with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman is surrendering his law license for 3 years to settle multiple misconduct violations stemming from his discredited review of the state's presidential vote in 2020, reports the Associated Press. During the probe, Gableman threatened the mayors of Green Bay and Madison with jail time, violated state open records law, and made false statements during court testimony and to state investigators, among other actions, which further fed election conspiracy theories surrounding President Donald Trump's loss in 2020. This temporary suspension of Gableman's law license follows a 10-count complaint filed last November by the State Office of Lawyer Regulation, or OLR. As part of the agreement with the OLR, Gableman admitted that he cannot defend against the allegations of misconduct as the complaint provides, quote, an adequate factual basis, unquote.
Meanwhile, Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Rebecca Bradley announced she plans to seek another 10-year term on the court after her current term expires next year, reports Wisconsin Examiner. Bradley, a conservative, made the announcement after Justice-elect Susan Crawford beat out Brad Schimmel in last week's election, preserving the liberal majority on the court. Bradley tells WIS Politics that she is running again because she's concerned for what a, quote, extremely radical court, unquote, will do over the next few years. Chris Taylor, an appeals court judge and a Democratic former state lawmaker, is considering running against Bradley in next year's race, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
The Trump administration's tariffs chaos has shaken business confidence across the nation, even as Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers and Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation CEO Missy Hughes are seeking international investments in the state through a trade mission to Europe. Wisconsin Examiner reports that Evers and Hughes embarked on a trade mission last week to France and Germany, where they encouraged European businesses to buy Wisconsin exports. The economic uncertainty that has escalated due to the Trump administration's imposition of steep tariffs and retaliatory tariffs by Canada, China, and other nations has quickly made Wisconsin business owners concerned about how to stay afloat. However, Hughes says she is optimistic that business ties Wisconsin has with other nations will, quote, stand strong, unquote, during this turmoil.
State legislation that would restrict access to firearms by domestic abuse offenders is being reintroduced this spring, reports Wisconsin Watch. Governor Tony Evers has stated that keeping firearms from the offenders is a priority of his administration. If passed, the legislation would close a loophole that currently allows domestic violence offenders in the state to possess guns. The legislation is informed by studies undertaken by End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, which found that women are several times more likely to be killed when an abuser has access to a firearm, and domestic violence-related charges usually precede a domestic violence homicide. Jenna Gormel, Public Policy Director of End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin, says that this legislation is common sense and should not be a partisan issue.
The National Council on Teacher Quality has found that only 3 higher education institutions in the state are providing prospective teachers with enough math education, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. This study follows closely on the heels of the U.S. Department of Education's National Assessment of Educational Progress, which found that nearly 25% of Wisconsin fourth graders lack basic math knowledge and skills. The Wisconsin schools that are getting a grade of A in math instruction for future teachers are UW-Stevens Point, UW-Milwaukee, and UW-Oshkosh. The scores were derived based on the total number of instructional hours that are dedicated to mathematics. Teacher programs with too few instructional hours in math have led to teachers entering the workforce without essential math knowledge. Throughout a student's academic journey, math knowledge is cumulative, so students struggling with math concepts in elementary school are likely to continue to struggle into middle and high school.
A tuition increase at UW-Madison may be on the horizon if the state legislature does not fully fund the university's budget request for 2025 to 2027. In an interview with Isthmus, UW-Madison spokesperson John Lucas stated that the Madison campus is not requesting a tuition increase at this time, but a tuition increase may be necessary if federal funding is cut further. David Murphy, the Associate Vice Chancellor for Finance at UW-Madison, has acknowledged that the potential for a tuition increase is caused by cuts to federal research. He also said the university does not want to put a, quote, disproportionate amount, unquote, of the cost of federal funding removal on students.
Dane County has installed two new harm reduction vending machines in Madison that provide the free life-saving medication naloxone and other items that can help prevent fatal drug overdoses. The new vending machines are located outside of St. Mary's Hospital and the UW Hospital and bring the total number of harm reduction vending machines in Madison to five, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. With the installation of these additional vending machines in highly accessible locations, this county hopes to remove the financial hurdles that prevent people from seeking out these life-saving medications. This decision was informed by a 2020 Madison and Dane County Public Health Review of overdose deaths in the region, which showed that nearly half of the people who died from drug overdoses had an emergency department visit within 1 year of their fatal overdose. Emergency medicine physicians at both hospitals are supportive of these machines and say that they will make a significant impact within the community.
Internet service has been restored in Madison schools this afternoon after an extended outage across the district. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that the outage was caused by a system issue or a configuration problem. The internet outage hindered lessons on Monday and Tuesday as teachers and students were unable to use computers for their lessons and other classroom activities. District spokesperson Adele Fiedler wrote that Madison teachers are prepared to provide offline learning in these situations, which is why schools remained open on Tuesday, despite starting the day with no internet. Those were tonight's headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
One lingering local question from last Tuesday's spring election has been answered. Alder Dina Nina Martinez Rutherford will accept a second term on the Madison Common Council. WORT News Director Shelley Pittman has more.
Dina Nina Martinez Rutherford didn't campaign for a second term as alder. No door knocking, no mailers, no meet and greets. She suspended her campaign in mid-January for a variety of reasons. Reasons she outlined at a press conference this morning, surrounded by local politicos outside the Eastmoreland Community Center.
And like many of our transgender siblings and family, I found myself overstretched with an impending new administration and a planned surgery that would have taken me out of the race for 3 weeks. Sadly, that didn't happen, but we can discuss that separately. And I'm also searching for a new place, and I wasn't sure in the most expensive, one of the most expensive districts in the city, if I was going to be able to find a housing that I could afford within our district.
She says that decision to suspend her campaign wasn't easy, but
with so many unknowns, I was concerned that I wouldn't be able to offer the consistent, grounded commitment to the campaign that it required. So I made the difficult decision to step out of the race, and I endorsed my opponent, and I offered him transition support, was helping him like I would do with anyone who would come after me in any position.
Still, due to paperwork requirements, Martinez Rutherford stayed on the ballot. Her competitor, Ryan Coughlin, who told WORT last month that he was still door knocking. But last Tuesday, Election Day, and Alder Dina Nina beat Coughlin by roughly 219 votes. And when we asked her last week whether she'd still accept the seat, she seemed in shock.
Wow.
Today, a week later, an answer. Martinez Rutherford will join the crowd of Alders returning to the council for another term.
I was looking forward to, you know, having a little bit of time to myself, but at a time when we are so under attack, not only federally, but even in the state, when trans people step up, when trans people show up and get elected, that's a huge, huge statement, and it's resistance. Mm. So I will accept.
Yes. 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 Come on. Woo-hoo.
And I will continue to serve District 15 as long as I'm able, and I will do so with courage, clarity, and deep care. And to everyone who believed in me and the possibility of this moment, thank you.
But the challenges that underpinned her decision to suspend her campaign remain, including the financial ones. City Alders are part-time and make a modest, roughly $15,000 a year.
And the truth is, I'm still looking for housing. I'm still financially struggling. My business never recovered from the pandemic. And we all know winning a seat is greater than just one person. It isn't winning an election. It's signing up for hard work, responsibility, and courage, and the courage to govern with care and love and boldness.
WORT asked Martinez Rutherford, who editorially contributes to our LGBTQ news program Query, if she'd serve out the two-year term.
I plan to serve as long as I'm able. If I can't find sustainable housing within the district or something else comes up, I need to financially resource myself too. Like, we don't talk about that a lot for elected officials, but there are some of us who are living in poverty and serving. So if there's a way that I can get a little more resource and it takes me away from Madison, I will be heartbroken, but I will follow that. But at this current time, nothing is clear. I am here, I've said yes, and I will show up until I can't.
Ryan Coughlin declined to comment to WORT today. This morning, Alder Martinez Rutherford highlighted the importance of representation in government. And she pushed back against the notion that voters in her district somehow hadn't known that she suspended her campaign.
And to suggest that our district, who is known for being highly informed and a highly engaged electorate, didn't know or weren't informed feels like a slap in the face to the voters.
And that's a sentiment echoed by the other Politico who spoke today, District 15 constituent Aleem Muldrow, also a WORT contributor, who last week won another term on the Madison School Board after running unopposed.
I think as a person who gets to vote for Dina, when I was in my polling place last week and kind of realizing the importance of this election, seeing Dina's name made me feel hopeful. And I think at times like this, we kind of cling to the things that give us hope, that give us faith in humanity, that allow for us to weather moments that are tremendously challenging together. And I thought that I was doing that alone, that I was making the decision to vote for somebody who is no longer running as just one person. And when she won, I realized that there were a lot of people clinging to hope.
The District 15 race wasn't the closest race on the ballot. Three other races were decided by less than 200 votes, including District 19 on the west side, where John Uguerre beat out Nino Amato by just 9 votes, according to a preliminary tally. Yesterday, the city announced that Amato has filed for a recount in the race, and that's slated to happen tomorrow at 9 a.m. in the Madison Municipal Building. Newly elected alders, including Alder Martinez Rutherford, are expected to take office later this month. For WORT News, I'm Shali Pittman.
The past couple of weeks have brought on more federal funding cuts from the Trump administration. Nonprofit groups across a variety of sectors are struggling to stay afloat. WORT News producer Faye Parks has more.
My husband and I, we have our tiny little family, us, two cats. We're at an age where for us personally, we'd like to start, you know, discussing more about having a kid or two and how we can just keep building our little family and being safe and protected.
Maria Troyer is the administrative officer at Wisconsin Humanities. She told WORT this afternoon that she joined the nonprofit for job security, but her employment, along with the employment of her 7 colleagues at Wisconsin Humanities, is up in the air after a notice last week from the National Endowment for the Humanities that all their grant funding has been canceled.
The funding was pulled away from us overnight. That funding that has already been appropriated by Congress and that they have indicated over and over they would like to see in the hands of their state humanities councils. 85% of our total funding, Wisconsin Humanities total funding, comes from those federal funds. The other 15% come from other organizations, individual donors, but 85% is just gone overnight. So we are limping along at this point, but we are expecting all to be laid off within a period of 2 months.
Wisconsin Humanities is one of 56 humanities councils across the country that receives grant funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Their mission over the last 50 years has been the preservation and celebration of our state's history and culture. Jessica Becker is Director of Communications at Wisconsin Humanities.
Communities come to us when they have projects, programs, things they're excited about and want to explore further using conversations and history and thinking about their futures. So we're responsive to what communities are interested in, and we do that. We respond through our grant program. We have programs of our own that serve the needs of our state as it evolves and changes.
Wisconsin Humanities provides training to local leaders, produces digital content, and awards small grants that help fund public projects across the state. They awarded $215,000 in small grants last year alone. DOGE didn't just cut grant funding to jurisdictional councils like Wisconsin Humanities last week. They also laid off 80% of the National Endowment staff. Troyer says Wisconsin Humanities is working to spread the word, appealing to donors to try and cover the loss of funding. But she adds that they expect the coffers to run out within 2 months.
The hope is that we can limp along until hopefully some legal action will occur. But we don't know how long that's going to take. And it's not just us. All 8 of us are now one of 280,000 who have been laid off as a result of DOGE. So that's federal workers and contractors and individuals like us who kind of fall somewhere in the middle.
If the federal funding isn't restored, Jessica Becker says, it would be a death knell for their organization.
We will not be able to continue our programs. We will not be able to continue our grant program. We will not be able to keep our doors open. So that federal grant is our budget. That is how we function. We do raise private funds. We do write grants for other support for specific projects. But without the operational grant, we cannot keep our doors open.
Compared to other humanities councils across the country, Wisconsin Humanities is particularly dependent on federal grant funding. Wisconsin consistently ranks at the bottom of the list for arts funding. As of February 2024, Wisconsin ranked 50th in the country, funding the arts at 15 cents per capita per year.
The loss of that federal money will be incredibly detrimental to Wisconsin because Wisconsin as a state is not picking up the slack. So other states that border Wisconsin invests as states much more highly than Wisconsin does as a state. Now, every state will be harmed by the loss of that federal funding to their state. But because Wisconsin is not already investing in each individual and giving money directly to cultural programming, it will be felt by every person in every county. Unfortunately, since we aren't getting that state money, we don't have anything to fall back on.
Wisconsin Humanities isn't the only local cultural nonprofit grappling with funding cuts. As we've reported recently, museums and libraries like the Madison Children's Museum and Madison Public Library are sounding the alarm and rethinking their funding streams as Trump dismantles the Institute of Museum and Library Services. Last Friday, Attorney General Josh Call signed onto a multi-state lawsuit challenging that cut. Meanwhile, the Literacy Network is also facing cuts to its programming, one that provides free support for people working towards U.S. citizenship. The org was awarded the Citizenship Instruction and Naturalization Application Services Grant in 2023, and since then has helped 175 people with classroom instruction and tutoring in English, civics, and U.S. history, as well as legal services provided in partnership with Centro Hispano. Literacy Network is slated to lose $74,000 in federal funding. They got a notice that their grant had been terminated last month. The notification writes that Literacy Network citizenship courses no longer serve the Department of Homeland Security's priorities, namely, their goal to stop funding quote-unquote illegal immigration. Robin Ryan is the executive director at Literacy Network.
This grant actually was only for people who were lawful permanent residents, so they are people who are following the process established by the federal government for applying for citizenship. So it really has nothing to do with so-called illegal immigration.
Ryan says the network is spreading the word about the funding cut in an effort to cover the gap through donations. But she adds that they'll most likely have to reduce their programming to cut costs.
There's a cost to becoming a citizen. You have to pay your filing fees. Plus, if you are needing to prepare, you might have to pay to go to classes. So if you don't have the free classes, maybe people who are eligible for citizenship just won't apply. And so that makes people just less secure, less tied into the community, unable to vote, unable to travel freely. So it keeps people in silos, and it makes our community less secure, and people have fewer opportunities in the economy if they don't move from the lawful permanent resident to citizenship.
For WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
It's
now 6:26 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Last Tuesday, former United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, gave a talk on the, quote, art of negotiation. When protesters objecting to war in Gaza disrupted the talk, the ambassador modeled negotiation skills on the spot. WORT reporter Kate Poppy has more.
Linda Thomas-Greenfield received her Master's of Public Administration from UW-Madison back in the 70s. And more recently, she served as the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations under former President Joe Biden. During her tenure, Thomas-Greenfield took aim at China for its genocide against Uyghurs. She spoke out over increasing tensions in Ethiopia, but she repeatedly cast the lone no vote for the humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza, calling the solution dangerous to both Israelis and Palestinians. Those no votes are part of why protesters interrupted Thomas-Greenfield last week as she returned to the UW-Madison campus for a conversation hosted by the La Follette School of Public Affairs. The talk was billed as The Art of Negotiation, Strategies for Respectfully Dealing with Disagreements and Forming Resolutions with Opposing Sides. But minutes into the talk, she was interrupted. Protesters, who carried a banner reading Free Palestine along with a megaphone, stood up near the front of the crowd. They asked Thomas-Greenfield about the children of Gaza, the ceasefire, and the Nakba, which was the Israeli displacement of Palestinian people in 1948.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We appreciate your sentiment. We're here to hear from the ambassador.
Actually, I'd like to respond. Would you like me to respond? Would you like me to respond? Would you like me to respond?
This is about you. This is about you. You're not welcome on this campus. You are a genocide of women.
The disruption lasted 8 minutes before the UW Police Department escorted the protesters out. UWPD says 3 students not affiliated with UW-Madison were detained. They add that the students were released and there is an ongoing investigation. But the disruption stayed with Thomas-Greenfield throughout the talk as she continued to expand on other topics like climate change and cybersecurity. Thomas-Greenfield noted that she did not independently veto the ceasefire in Gaza.
You know, I like the fact that people think all alone, by myself, I made the decision and decided that I was going to veto a resolution without any consultation with anybody.
Totally fair.
And I wish I had that power, because if I had that power, I might have made some different decisions. They all appreciate what you all are doing here. They appreciate your raising your voices in support of them. But we also have to give their voice a chance to be heard. and have them sit at the table. One of the most interesting meetings I had, I invited Palestinians and Jewish students to come to the mission and talk to each other. And what they concluded at the end of that talk is they were both suffering. They both felt the same pain. And they had a better understanding of each of their different positions. And when I left, they are continuing to meet and try to find solutions. It is about bringing people together and finding solutions.
In March of last year, Thomas Greenfield wrote an op-ed that was published in the New York Times titled "The Unforgivable Silence on Sudan." She writes that the civil war in Sudan is one of the deadliest wars that many people have never heard of.
We were very, very focused on the situation in Gaza. We were focused on the situation in Ukraine. And people were dying by the dozens every single hour in Sudan. More than 1 million people were forced from their homes. Women were being raped every single day, and nobody cared. And sometimes when I would talk about it, I would get audience screaming, "What about Gaza?" And Sudan is not any less important. The people of Sudan are not any less important than people suffering elsewhere in the world.
After the presentation, Thomas Greenfield modeled her negotiation strategies by inviting one of the quiet protesters who wasn't arrested on stage to have a conversation. Pat Patterson, Karen Kendrick Hans, Larry Hans, and Bruce Kahn, who attended the event, shared their thoughts.
I thought she made good use of the opportunity in being willing to dialogue and to emphasize that it wasn't her personal unilateral veto. She had to do the work of the people who hired her.
It was sort of like watching diplomacy in action.
Yeah, and that's what she's doing right now.
Yeah.
The person who held his hand up, waited patiently, yeah. And he obviously has something to say.
And she's working with him.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Kate Poppy.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm Sarah Hopeful, here with Christian Knutson. Thanks for joining us. One correction to our earlier story, a planned recount for District 19 is this Thursday at 9 a.m., not tomorrow. Thanks to the Trump administration's sweeping sets of tariffs, market prices for dairy products have gone down significantly in recent weeks. Those declining prices have lost Wisconsin dairy farmers $100 million over the last month. Pete Hardin tells host Bert Zipperer that the dairy industry is the canary in the coal mine in this edition of The Milkweed.
Welcome to The Milkweed on WORT. I'm Bert Zipperer, and we're talking with Pete Hardin, who for 46 years, almost 47, has been publisher and editor of the monthly newspaper The Milkweed, dairy farming's best information and insights with their motto, "Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee." Pete is a descendant of a long line of dairy activist farmers. Today's topic are tariffs and being tariffied. Hi, Pete.
Thank you, Bert.
Let's talk about tariffs and dairy markets.
Okay, well, I think first of all, we should note we're recording this on Friday, April 4th.
So things are happening.
For broadcast the following Tuesday, things are wild right now with the whole tariff-based disruptions in our economy. And I would paint the dairy industry as the first canary in the coal mine in terms of the negative economic impact of the tariff war threats and now realities of all this economic craziness.
Well, talk a little bit about why dairy would be such an early indicator.
Well, let's go by the numbers. During the first quarter of 2025, dairy commodities, and specifically cheddar cheese, whey, butter, and non-fat dry milk or powdered milk, those commodities on average have lost about 25 cents per pound in their value in cash market trading down in Chicago.
And that's a huge, huge drop.
Yes. Cheddar being down about 27 cents per pound through earlier this week. That translates easily into a $2.50, $2.75 per hundredweight decline in the farm milk price. Whey, the residual high protein byproduct from cheese making, whey prices have declined roughly 25, 26 cents per pound. The way the federal commodity-based pricing system works, that's an automatic loss of 6 cents per pound of whey. That's about $1.50 to $1.60, again, off the farm milk price. So then there's butter down about 30 cents per pound during the first quarter. So as you put all these negative commodity factors into the pricing system, I predict that Wisconsin dairy farmers' milk checks for April 25 milk production will be at least $4 per hundredweight lower than what the farmers received in January for their milk.
And the price went from what to what?
And we're talking 2050, 21, down to perhaps 16.5, 17.
So you're talking percentage-wise a huge percent.
Yeah, Bert, and that, in a one-month basis, a $4 decline in Wisconsin dairy farmers' milk prices equals $100 million of lost rural Wisconsin milk check cash flow.
In that month?
In 1 month, and hitting at the time when spring expenses for planting are the highest.
So how much dairy and milk products, what percent gets exported?
Last year, according to the USDA, roughly 18, the equivalent of 18% of all U.S. farm milk was exported. That's one of the highest statistics ever. For example, Mexico is our predominant dairy outlet. Mexico bought almost 40% of all our cheese that was exported last year, 10% of our butter, and 50% of our non-fat dry milk. That's half of all our non-fat dry milk produced in the U.S. Meanwhile, Canada bought 61% of all of our cream and butter exports. And then China, number three, China primarily buys whey and lactose. Now, the Mexican tariffs, given all the uncertainty of recent days, I'm not sure how much Mexico's tariffs are going to increase. I think it's about 10% on incoming Mexican goods, which will perhaps generate countervailing duties assessed on U.S. products going out. But Canada is right up there in high tariffs. And China, goodness gracious, I'm still trying to figure out how much China's paying.
It's big.
It's like 34%. And so those are our three biggest dairy export customers to the United States. And interestingly, our State Secretary of Agriculture, Randy Romanski, was quoted on public radio this week noting that 60% of all of Wisconsin's agricultural exports go to those three nations, Mexico, Canada, and
60%.
China.
Now, you were talking about how dairy is the canary in the coal mine, and you were also showing me earlier how much almost real-time data comes out regarding pricing and production, which makes whatever happens known pretty quickly.
Every day, the cash commodity prices are traded and then announced at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange for cheddar blocks, cheddar barrels, non-fat dry milk, whey, and butter. The pricing system is almost on a daily basis, daily or weekly.
So your information is hot and current.
Unfortunately, in this case. Yeah. Bert, for our listeners, I'd like to explain that dairy has a daily cadence, and let's keep it Wisconsin-centric. Dairy has a daily cadence. The cows make the milk every day. They can't be shut off. Here in Wisconsin, 90% of our milk goes into cheese. Once that milk is manufactured into cheese, the operator of the cheese plant has a decision. Can the operator sell it to a middle person or end user, or does the operator of the cheese plant have to inventory the cheese? So with all this uncertainty about the value of export opportunities diminishing and a cooling domestic economy at the same time, dairy commodity prices are dropping because the marketing structure, the farm to consumer supply chain is scared about future demand, and therefore as inventories build, prices decline, and that's reflected in the prices farmers will receive for their milk.
I've heard cheese is milk made immortal. That while milk lasts for a week to 10 days, cheese can make it last forever. However, with the tariffs and with the markets the way they are, you might be immortal, but we don't know it's going to be what the profit or loss will be.
At a certain point, aged cheese starts deteriorating. I'm not sure immortal is the right word, but
there is an end.
It's milk in a wonderful solid state as long as somebody wants to eat it. So we have the regular cadence of the industry, which leaves it vulnerable to these supply chain and disruptions, such as tariffs. And we have the confidence factor. And the confidence factor is eroding before our very eyes, as witnessed by commodity prices.
And we're heading into the spring flush, which is the natural time of year where the volume of milk production goes up.
Correct. Cows' natural inclination is to calve in the spring and eat that fresh grass or fresh hay and make more milk.
And there we go. Well, we have to wrap it up there for this week. We'll be back next week with Pete and the milkweed. This is Bert Zipper. Thank you for listening.
Brent Mann and his wife, Michelle Duval, opened Blind Shot Social Club 4 years ago on Madison's East Side, blending together their experience in food, beverages, and golf. Mann talks about creating and serving mocktails with feature contributor Emily Tucker in this edition of Stuff Your Face.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Stuff Your Face. Today, I am sitting down with someone I go way back with, my childhood next-door neighbor, Brent Mann. Brent, thanks so much for joining me. You own Blind Shot Social Club here on Fair Oaks Avenue with your wife, Michelle Duval. What a cool spot you have here. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. Good to see you again.
Tell us about Blind Shot Social Club. What has your journey been like to get here today?
It's been pretty long and meandering. My wife has been in the food and drink industry her whole career, and I have not. I've been primarily in the golf industry, but always had, you know, kind of my toe in food and restaurants and stuff. But when we started dating 8-9 years ago now, we kicked the idea around and thought it'd be fun, open up some place that, you know, obviously had food and drinks and maybe a golf simulator or something to kind of combine the two worlds. And in 2019, we really drove forward with the business plan and really made it a serious thing. Went to a couple banks, and fast forward to 2020, we got approval from our bank that our business plan was great, got funding. 5 days later, the lockdown happened.
Hit.
Yep. So we closed on our business loan 5 days before the lockdown started. So that put like basically a year stop on everything and kind of a weird time. But then 2021 came around and our bank was like, do you guys still want to do this? And we're like, why not? Let's go for it. June of 2021, we formally opened. We'll be coming up on our 4th anniversary this summer.
Congratulations. So many folks I talk to in the food world, just hearing how they made it through that time. It's truly a testament to you all as business owners. So amazing. And, you know, I hear a lot of people talk about your mocktail selection, you know, on the Madison Foodies Facebook group, really positive comments. So many folks are either cutting back on drinking or just quitting altogether these days. So tell us about your mocktail menu.
It's kind of an interesting genesis because my wife doesn't drink and I've never drank for no good reason. reason. So the two of us were like, well, we should kind of focus on some, you know, non-alcoholic alternatives for some people. And initially started as kind of a core thing of our menu to have those options. And it's grown into about a third of our entire bar program is non-alcoholic. So beer, wine, cocktails. My wife, Michelle, puts a tireless amount of work into creating them. The only thing I really can contribute is some of the names of the cocktails. We take a lot of pride in that.
Yes, so there are lots of comments online about how great your names are on your menu. Drink-wise, it sounds
it's
like.
It's a fun thing to kind of participate with people. And, like, you know, it's a good conversation starter when people go to say the name of a drink and we'll kind of say, do you know what that's from? And they're like, no, we just, and like, then it kind of jump starts a conversation about a movie or a song or something. So, yeah, so the NA is a huge part of our business. We've been fortunate enough to win several consecutive Best of Madison NA Cocktail Awards. That's a huge testament to how much work my wife puts into it and the community just, you know, wanting that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's great timing. And I don't know how we grew up next door to each other and you never drank and my sister and I definitely did, but, you know, we've all come out in a good place.
Yeah, it's a different thing to have such a prevalent NA menu in a city like Madison. But we stress to people, like, you know, that it's not a mandatory thing. You know, like, you know, we got plenty of top shelf bourbons and we have a full regular alcohol menu.
Yeah.
You know,
it's just inclusive. People can come and not feel like, oh gosh, I don't want to hang out at a bar because I don't drink anymore. They can still come and enjoy the ambiance, atmosphere, and the food.
It's just giving people options.
Yeah, absolutely. So speaking of options, you all have a delicious looking menu. You have crab rangoon nachos, which sound delightful. So who comes up with your menu items and your recipes?
It's a lot of me and Michelle. We see things, you know, we're food junkies.
Food obsessed.
And, you know, we be it scrolling through Instagram or, you know, making something at home and thinking, oh, we should try that. We'll throw it together in the kitchen. And if it works, great. If it doesn't, that's kind of the luxury of having your own place is you can throw some stuff on the wall, see what sticks.
Does Michelle cook here? Or do you have a head chef that you can then bounce ideas off of?
We do, and it's a lot of just the two of us just kicking ideas around and, like, not having to go to a board or, you know, investor group and say, you know, hey, we're going to change the menu up this spring or something. We'll say, nope, we're just going to change it. And we kind of pride ourselves in having a limited menu, but we revolve our specials every week. So it gives us the flexibility to throw something out there and try a new flatbread or try a new type of burger or, you know, a vegan dish and just kind of mix it up. And if it doesn't work, then we won't do it. Some things move their way to the main menu, some things don't, but it's a fun option to have.
Speaking of scrolling on social media, you have great photos of your food on your website, on your social media. I know that that doesn't come naturally to everyone. So do you all take those photos or do you hire a photographer? What do you do?
Every photo that we have has been taken from my phone and edited through my wife's, or Michelle takes, you know, 95% of them, but it's a lot of painstaking. You know, people think it's just, I'll slap a filter on it, but it's, you have to have a very keen eye, which she does, to continuity and keeping that consistent and taking the photos and then having the caption have a voice, you know, and a narrative. And so it's consistent week to week. And it's, you know, kind of speaks to who we are, tongue in cheek and fun, but also addresses what the photo contains.
Yeah. Shout out to Michelle, doing great work. So what's your favorite thing on your menu to stuff your face with?
I would say probably the fancy pigs in a blanket, which is basically just chicken apple sausage. And then we do our little spin on a pig in a blanket. I would say I make those the most for myself in a given week, which is quite often. And I think that's kind of, people say, like, oh, you must get sick of your own food. And it's like, well, that's the nice thing is, like, we don't. We have the things on the menu that we like. We have a small freezer for, like, some desserts, but we don't freeze any of our stuff. We, you know, hand cut our fries every day. We don't get our patties made and then frozen and shipped in. We hand patty everything. So everything we have, we see how it gets made and we enjoy eating it.
And then you can switch it up whenever you want to. Love it. So what's next for you all here at Blind Shot Social? Anything fun planned for the summer?
Yeah, we're going to be doing a teenies and weenies day. So we'll pair some different martinis with different hot dog specials. Fun summer thing that we'll have for people. We do Margarita Mondays during the summer as well. And then we're also going to be doing a fun event. One of our big items on the menu is our goat cheese balls. We've sold, I won't say how many we've sold because it's going to be part of the contest that we're doing, but we've sold a shocking amount of those since we opened. And so we're going to be doing a goat cheese ball eating contest this summer, which is outrageous, but also kind of fun.
Outrageous is a good word. Yeah. I love goat cheese. Well, everyone should keep their ears out, keep their eyes out. You have outdoor seating here, which is great. You're right near the Garver Feed Mill. You're right here on Fair Oaks Avenue. Great neighborhood. Brent, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk with me today.
It's wonderful to see you again.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
It's now 6:50 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. It's the busiest time of year at the Dane County Humane Society's Wildlife Rehabilitation Center. Spring has sprung and the flood of migratory birds and new baby animals bring unique challenges. Jackie Sandberg shares some updates and tips on how to prevent window strikes on tonight's Wildlife Weekly. It's
Welcome to Wildlife Weekly. My name is Jackie Sandberg, and I'm the Wildlife Program Manager for the Dane County Humane Society here in Madison, Wisconsin. Each week, we choose a topic related to wildlife rehabilitation or the environment, and today I want to talk about a number of wildlife updates from baby season to what we should be expecting as the biggest dangers to wildlife right now coming up here in the busy spring. So we know that it's April, and we have seen lots of birds already coming back from migration for the spring. So our Wildlife Center has been seeing a number of migratory species in the area or admitted to the Wildlife Center. So for us, that would include American robins. We see them all over the place outside, especially when they're looking in the areas around traffic. If you've looked out your window of your car, definitely take a peek and see how many robins you can count on the ground. To me, it's kind of incredible how many of them are spaced out in such a small area. And if you watch them closely, they are running around on the ground, stopping, tilting their heads, kind of looking curiously at the grass, and then sometimes they'll pull up a worm. I think it's awesome because that's how they're looking for their food. They are looking and feeling for vibration of worms underneath the earth, and they're actually listening when they cock their heads to the side. But of course, the traffic going by is going to impact their ability to get those worms, and it puts them at pretty high risk to being hit by cars or being scared off in a direction where they accidentally hit a window. So we've seen a number of robins already coming through or having calls from members of the public about robins that are showing aggressive behavior towards windows. It's the breeding season. So you'll see robins making nests, maybe on your porch, on a lamp, outside in a tree. But if they see the reflection in the glass, they can start to attack themselves. And, you know, there's a chance that they could hurt themselves. So between the areas where they're foraging and they're at risk to being hit by cars, there's also the risk around homes where they're building nests and having territorial disputes all throughout those areas. So for American robins and other birds that do have that territorial response to a reflection of a male that they think is going to encroach in their territory, our best suggestion is to put up some sort of material so that they can block the reflection. So you could hang curtain rods in the type of, you know, suggestion be similar to preventing window strikes, which we have lots of information on our website about. And you can go to www.giveshelter.org to look for that information about how to prevent window strikes. So there's corded knots that you can use. You can hang a sheet. You can put up newspaper on the outside. So again, you're trying to stop the reflection of the glass. So putting something on the outside of the window is going to actually be best temporarily. You could put up a piece of cardboard, or you could use something like UV highlighters or decals or stickers or something to help keep them from wanting to do that. Really, in all honesty, it's a little different than just simply covering the reflective parts. It's more keeping that window that they might be attacking in a soft padded environment almost for them to actually just completely stop altogether. Because if they have just one little decal in a corner, they'll just move to another side of the window that shows their reflection. So something to keep in mind right now. We've also seen a number of yellow-bellied sapsuckers that have started to come through the Wildlife Center. Many of them are going to hit windows through migration because they see the foliage reflected in the window and think that they can land onto a tree. Alternatively, on our mammals in that front, we've definitely seen an increased number of possums. We are calling it the year of the possums at DCHS because we have so many adults in care, and many of them coming through because they've been hit by cars or were found sick in the backyard. Some of them have had evidence of lead toxicity, so in their blood, when they're eating certain types of foods that could have some kind of contamination with lead, usually through the trophic system, bioaccumulation in the environment, something like earthworms is an example of a species that can have high lead because of the soils they're eating, and our very acidic soils in the Wisconsin area can break down lead that's been sitting in the environment. So that's one thing that you could see in a number of species that eat worms, but for possums that could be one way. Otherwise, they are eating off of lots of different things, you know, scavenging on carcasses and such. So we do see it in those guys. We also have some possums that have already had babies, so we have little Joeys in the pouches, so they might have come in hit by car with an injury, but then we also find that they're pregnant. So, you know, it's that time of year where baby animals are being born, and we're seeing squirrels, we're seeing rabbits, we're starting to see so many different species. So please be on the lookout for those little baby animals, because some of the highest risks to wildlife at this time of year is going to be not only their parents somehow getting injured and not being able to return back to the care of their babies, but also those babies ending up displaced, maybe from a predator or an accidental kidnapping, or what we call it is the abduction of with the intent of rescue, meaning that people might take them from the environment thinking that the parents aren't there, but really they actually are. And remember, the best thing for those animals are their parents, not humans, because their rate of success is going to drop dramatically in rehabilitation, despite what you think might be the best. Their parents are always best for them, just like our humans. They want to be raised by, you know, humans. We want our bunnies to be raised by bunnies, squirrels to be raised by squirrels, etc. So that applies for all species. And then we also have issues with some of those baby animals being interacted with our pets. So, you know, things like outdoor cats and dogs. Make sure to be aware that baby animals might be out on the ground, like our baby great horned owls, for instance. Right now, we've had a number where they've been on the ground and maybe a dog is walking up to sniff them. Same with baby bunnies, baby squirrels. So just know that, you know, obviously with the risk of wildlife disease transfer, parasites, and so many other issues that, you know, especially free roaming cats, for example, or community cats might have with wildlife, or, you know, dogs running out in the yard and then injuring or biting a wild animal, we're going to see more of those interactions, and we've already started to get calls about them. So be on the lookout, be aware that that is happening, and that we are here as a resource in the community. So if you find any sick, injured, or orphaned wild animals, please give us a call at 608-287-3235. So thank you for listening today here on WORT. We've been talking about some of the species we've been seeing here in the last few weeks at the Wildlife Center. Knowing that the spring migration is coming up, we're starting to see mammals that have babies and so much more. So thank you for your support and appreciation for everything that is wildlife. This has been Wildlife Weekly.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Aisha Malik.
Kate Poppier is your reporter.
Special thanks to feature contributors Pete Harden, Bert Zipperer, Christine Vertigo, Emily Tucker, and Jackie Sandberg.
Super Dave Lawrence engineered the show.
Faye Parks produced this newscast.
Sally Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And I'm your host, Christian Knutson. Up next is Spanish language news with Nuestro Patio. Good night.
The 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival is going on now, all over Madison until April 10th. There are over 170 films of all shapes and sizes for you to choose from. This includes some of the best cinema from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. Choose from comedies, dramas, experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. You can catch these films at the Bartell Theater, the Barrymore Theater, and four venues on the UW campus. The last 4 days of the festival will take place at Flick's Brewhouse, located at the Easttown Mall. A guide to all the films and where they will be shown is available in the March issue of the Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The Wisconsin Film Festival is happening now through April 10th on a screen near you, helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years. This is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
And at 7 o'clock, you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Stay tuned. Coming up next in Nuestro Patio.
Bienvenido a Nuestro Patio, un espacio en Word para la comunidad latina.
Panamá.
Presente.
Puerto Rico.
Presente.
México.
Presente.
Venezuela.
Presente.
Perú.
Presente.
República Dominicana.
Presente.
Cuba.
Presente.
Costa Rica.
Presente.
Colombia.
Presente.
Honduras.
Presente.
Ecuador.
The High Noon Saloon presents Natty Nation's Almost 420 Reggae Party on Saturday, April 19th at 7 p.m. Natty Nation blends authentic reggae with elements of rock, soul, and funk to create a unique Midwestern sound. Natty are joined by Czar, a genre-bending collective that blends the sounds of psychedelic rock with groovy, rhythmic soul and funk, along with your hosts, DJs Trichome and VPS. More information can be found at high-noon.com. The High Noon Saloon presents Natty Nation's Almost 420 Reggae Party with special guests Czar and hosted by DJs Trichome and VPS on Saturday, April 19th at 7 p.m. at the High Noon Saloon. Live music lives at WORT Madison.